hour number two of the Bible study. I'm Chuck Rather. Thank you for joining us here today. Our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Let's say good morning and welcome to Pastor Bill Deekleman. I guess I really should say, to be correct, Vice President Bill Deekleman. He is first Vice President of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, does his work in Kirkwood at the Church Bodies International Center, but spends a lot of time on the road, and is, I guess, kind of the right-hand man to President Gerald Kieschnick in the administrative part of the Church Body of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and a guy who just had, for him, kind of a not-so-busy August, he said. He's getting ready to gearing up to do a lot of traveling here in the last 4 months of this year, but August, you had a little downtime, did you?
Had a little bit of downtime, and in the midst of all that was the Black Ministry Convocation in Washington, D.C., the Theological Convocation right here in St. Louis. Board of Directors met also in August, so there was...
Doesn't sound like much downtime. So let's talk about the Black Ministry Convocation mm-hmm. a little bit. Tell me what that is in terms of within the structure. How is that set up?
It is a freestanding conference that the 258 Black churches in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod put on every couple of years. They are represented by the each congregation can send delegates or representatives, and they do conduct some kind of business among that conference for themselves. But chiefly it is an occasion to get together to worship, fantastic worship experience. I had an opportunity to address that gathering for a little while following the choir. And I mentioned to the choir director, this is an incredible thing. How did you find time and preparation, you know, to get these people together? And he said, well, we just did an hour last night. And it sounded wonderful.
People.
Very talented people.
You know, it's said that this most segregated hour in the United States of America is still the Sunday morning worship hour. And so some folks may be wondering how it is that, at least in their perception, a largely white church with Germanic roots fits in with the African American worship experience. How do you describe transcending those barriers and those issues?
Mm-hmm. I tell you the worship was the focus of the Black Ministry Convocation. Very formal times each day during the 3-day conference. Preachers invested. Formal music, and it was something that lifted my spirits and energized me as an Anglo person, one of the few Anglo people sitting there in that room, to listen to some of my good friends and favorite preachers is always a thrill for me, and it's worth attending for that, if for no other reason.
Now I want to take you back a couple of months here. I have the Church Body's newspaper, The Reporter, in my hand. And page one headline is Conference Stresses Ministry With, and the word with is italicized, Conference Stresses Ministry With Children, which connotes or suggests to me, just looking at the headline, that they intentionally wanted to say with and not to.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a correct assumption?
It's hardly an assumption. That's accurate information.
And with this story is a photograph of you sitting, looks like, at the front of a sanctuary, sitting there with three young people, a young man using a microphone. He's reading something here. So
Spencer.
I take it that, is that Spencer?
That's Spencer.
I take it that you played an important role in this conference?
I had, thanks for mentioning this. I had received an invitation, maybe last summer about this time, from Judy Christian in the Synod's District and Congregational Services Department, who was responsible for family ministry and for children's ministry. And Judy said, would you be willing to be interviewed by some children at this conference. And I said, yeah, it sounds like a pretty good idea. And sometimes when people interview me, they give me some kind of notion what's coming. And when I arrived in the Chicago area in Schaumburg, Illinois, where this conference took place, they made it crystal clear that I'm not going to be given.
You're not going to get to know the questions before the moment?
You're not getting to prepare. These kids want to know what's in the heart and the head of the first vice president of the Senate. And I said, you know, that's just a wonderful thing. And I learned some great lessons, Chuck, lessons that I wish I would have learned years ago when I was serving full-time in a parish.
Such as?
I was, thinking the night before in preparation for this interview. Now,
how do you prepare for an interview with me?
Yeah. If I'm a kid, what am I going to ask this guy? So who's your favorite Bible character? What's your favorite Bible verse? What's your favorite part of going to church and things like that? And while they did ask some of that, and I was grateful to respond, there were other questions, though, that taught me something. And the questions were, what do you like to eat? When you go to the restaurant, what do you order? What's your favorite car?
Mm.
And they did want to know what was my favorite Bible passage. But I was telling President Kieschnick when we had a moment together after this, I, for years as a parish pastor, have been teaching children from the perspective of me being an adult, teaching them what I thought they needed to know in a way that they needed to learn it. And I learned that these three kids in particular were curious about me as a Christian man. They wanted to know where did I grow up.
They wanted to know who Bill Diekelman is.
What did I do as a boy? And how did I spend my summer? And they did exactly want to know that. And I think that while I may have shared some of those things in a confirmation class about myself, I hardly ever did that with a fourth grade student or with somebody else to sit down for an hour and say, you know, when I was your age, this is what I did. And this is what my pastor taught me and how he taught me. It was a very valuable time for me.
What's the difference between ministry with children and ministry to children?
You know, for years I would listen to people say, Pastor, we have to make sure we do this or budget this amount of money to spend on the children because they are the church of tomorrow. And I spent a lot of time saying, these children are the church of today. This is Christianity today. This is our congregation. This is our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And it's high time that we engaged children to be part of every aspect of the life of a Christian congregation rather than become the objects of Christian education for 1 hour on Sunday morning or an hour on Wednesday night, but to involve them in the life of our parish.
What do you say to the person who laments the loss of respect for authority in our culture? And a generation ago, the pastor was an authority figure. And he was the teacher, and the kids were the students, and he told them what to study and what to learn and what to memorize, and they studied, learned, and memorized it, and that was pretty much it. And those are the good old days, Pastor Diekelman, and I wish we could get back to that. That's kind of running in the opposite direction of what you're talking about. How do you respond to that?
I used to begin the first session of my confirmation class with, and depending on how it was structured at the time, sometimes with fifth graders and with their parents. Always invited the parents at the very beginning. In fact, I invited parents to come and be part of every class that I taught because Martin Luther, right on the very front page of Luther's Small Catechism, said these words, as the head of the household should teach his children.
There you go. Authority.
Yeah, authority. And the authority then and now is with that family. And I believe the place of the pastor, the place of the church, is certainly as a resource, guidelines, information, but it should not take the place of what can and should be happening inside of your home. And the authority really is with parents. And the authority really is within the structure of the family. And there is a place for the pastor in that family situation. There is a place for congregation in that situation. Maybe not as the final word, the absolute authority, but certainly as a place where information may be available that's not readily available at home.
Well, in some ways, just speaking for myself, I regret the loss of respect for authority that I've seen over the course of my lifetime. I think it's been counterproductive in many ways. But there's a flip side to everything. And it seems to me that one of the things that we have gained is we've stopped thinking and treating children so much as objects mm-hmm. and maybe as persons or as subjects, mm-hmm. which I think is a good thing.
It's a good thing.
Is that the focus of this conference?
That was exactly the focus of this conference. It was the first conference of this kind aimed at ministry with children. About 500 participants, as I think about looking around the room right now. And much of the conference was in small group sessions. You take your pick for a little workshop kind of area here. And while there were some fantastic facilitators, I stuck my head in a few of them, and much of the learning that was going on was interactive. In Iowa, in our parish, this is what's going on. In California, in our parish, this is what's going on. We've learned that this works. We've learned that this works. This doesn't work for us. So it was a time to share stories and learnings that people in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod have going on in their places.
So when an experienced, mature individual takes time to actually listen to what a child has to say, as opposed to just clinging to children should be seen and not heard, you don't hear that mantra very much anymore.
Mm-mm.
But when a mature person actually does respect what a young person has to say or ask, as I think you learned in this conference, what do you find out?
Well, that, number one, children are very intelligent. We have some education programs in the United States of America right now that I think are raising the intelligence level, and our children have had the opportunity to experience life in a way that I didn't. There are gadgets that they hold in their hands or watch on the television, and just the exposure to the world more than I ever have, than I had when I was somebody that age. My world was pretty narrow back then, which I think gives...
But it was safer.
Well, could be, maybe. I think now it gives teachers and parents a perspective of God, of Scripture, of the Church, that's more than my 700 or 1,000 member community where I grew up, for instance.
Well, there's no doubt that children are more sophisticated mm-hmm. sooner mm-hmm. than a generation ago. And many of the things you just said there are very optimistic and positive. However, it is dangerous in many ways to be a child in American society these days. Maybe the most dangerous place for a child is in the womb. Beyond that, some of the crimes that we have seen, which seem to happen monthly, if not weekly, and children being abused, it's terrible. What are your concerns for young people in American society these days?
There are a few that come to mind right now. One is the readiness of information available to children. I was just reading in the Post-Dispatch last week or the week before about books available in the public libraries here in St. Louis that some parents are saying, I don't want my child to be reading that kind of sexually oriented information, which is available. So, number one, I think that kind of information, sexually oriented information, is available not only to read, but on the television
yeah.
all the time. And I was recalling with one of my children not too long ago, watching I Love Lucy or this thing with Dick Van Dyke, Mary Tyler Moore mm-hmm. years ago. When you saw a scene of their bedroom, it was separate beds.
Yeah.
And when they were in bed, they were, you know, one in each bed. But that's, you know, that was more than...
That's pretty much over.
That's pretty much over. So our whole attitude about things that when I was a child were off limits. I don't think I heard out loud the word divorce until maybe I was in high school. If that word even was spoken, it was whispered, you know, among parents and relatives and things like that. And if I ever raised a question, you know, why isn't Tommy's mom and dad living in the same house anymore? Well, you'll find out later on when you grow up or things like that.
So you were very protected.
Very protected, right?
I want you to use an opportunity here to say something on behalf of the Lutheran education institutions, preschools, elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, colleges. If the culture, if the society is more dangerous for children than it used to be, for some of the reasons you just enumerated, it seems to me, well, let me just set it up this way. In an immigration from Germany to the United States, where German settlers who were Lutherans came here to find a new life, in many cases they started schools. And they wanted to start schools so that they could preserve the theological heritage that they left Germany to preserve. That's why they emigrated. It's 150 years later now, give or take. And now America is so much bigger. It's so pluralistic. And that pluralism is represented in an extensive and, to a large extent, successful public education system. But you're not going to find Jesus Christ in that public education system. As a matter of fact, if you do, there's probably a lawsuit coming.
Mm-hmm.
So you have Lutheran schools. Can you talk about that? Your Bill Diekelman's perspective on Lutheran schools.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. I know that my wife, Carol, is listening right now. And just on her way home from our church, Webster Gardens, where... this morning, she has been watching the children of women while they were in her Bible class. And my wife, for 15 years, when we were in a previous parish, served as the preschool teacher. She and another woman from our congregation began that. And we, as a congregation, were part of a Lutheran school association. We were part of an elementary school. I think that... that there is no finer ministry a Christian congregation can provide than a way to be with children at every age and to provide them with teachers, number one, that are moral, that are Christian, that are concerned about children and about getting them right information. And about not having to necessarily tiptoe around sensitive issues, but can, with the cooperation of parents, make sure that these children are instructed in a way that that protects them, and not just for this moment, but for the rest of their life. One day, you know, mom and dad are going to have to say, you know, you're on your own now. So I've been on every one of our university campuses across the United States, and they, to an institution, each number one have a fine president and boards of regents that are concerned about our children and about every student that's on that campus, some of them not Christian, that are on our university campuses, and we have an opportunity to influence them. Every parish pastor has an opportunity to exercise his influence in that way. Every Christian parent has an opportunity through their own children in our school system to influence those that are part of this pluralism that you talked about before, and provide Christian information.
It seems to me that that educational setting, where you can teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, and the fourth R, religion, if you will, where you can transfer the faith to the next generation and do it in a way that's unencumbered by whatever state regulations there are, is more important now than ever before.
Right.
But I'm not so sure that those parents who are in the business of educating their young children now are so much aware of that. Seems like the comparisons to the public education system have more to do with, you know, who does better in testing and and who has more programs and who has better athletic opportunities, things like that. And then, oh, yeah, you're going to learn the catechism when you're in the Lutheran school. Mm-hmm. Do we have our priorities a little mixed up?
Well, I can't speak for, I don't even know who is the average parent in our country today. I know that parents are concerned that that their children have an opportunity to succeed, to excel, and test scores are important. We live in a nation right now where not even half the people even profess to be Christian. And oftentimes when I speak to people who identify myself as a pastor or just engage them in conversation and they identify themselves as a Christian, I sometimes ask, so where do you go to church? Oh, I go to such and such a church. And who is your pastor? And where's your church building located? Oh, it's over on the east side of town. So some people have a passing association with Christianity that they may feel, you know, they are in deep with that. So for a whole nation to not even say we are Christian, it's not an important thing for them. Religion is not an important thing for them. Not nearly as important as you know, getting a high score on the ACT or the SAT test or learning how to play the tuba.
If you had friends who were on the bubble trying to decide whether or not to send their kids to the public school or the Lutheran school, and we'll just subtract the money involved here, and I realize that's an important factor, but just the philosophical, what would you say to convince them to go with a Christian education?
I think there are a couple of things. Number one, you can trust the instructors in Lutheran schools. They have either been trained in one of our institutions of higher education. Many of them were raised their entire life in Lutheran schools. So number one, you can trust that. You can trust the congregation that is with which that school is associated to know that there is a clergyman there or other people there that are going to be respectful for their children and watch out for their children. You can trust that the teachers are Christians and bring to the classroom not just reading and writing and arithmetic, but bring an attitude about life and a perspective from life that will be demonstrated in their conversation and other teaching methods.
You're listening to the Bible Study. Ask the Pastor. We'll be back after this short break.
Hi, I'm Pastor Doug Nicely. One of my favorite gospel singers, Buddy Green, sings about a church service where people are praising God, but Jesus has left the building. Maybe this verse from the Epistle to Romans would be one of the verses Buddy was thinking about. As for the one who is weak in the faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. This week we're going to talk about what happens when Jesus leaves the building on In His Steps.
Saturday at noon with Pastor Doug Nicely on AM 850 KFUO.
Do you enjoy science fiction? Sci-fi movie fans can grab their blankets and snacks and head to Sci-Fi Saturdays on the lawn of the planetarium at 7:30 Saturday evenings throughout September. Chairs and coolers are welcome, light refreshments are available, and parking is free at the planetarium and in Forest Park. In case of inclement weather, the event will be canceled. For information on Sci-Fi Saturdays, look online at slsc.org.
Why would an ant wear a fur coat? Find out next on today's Creation Moment.
And now, here's our Creation Moments host, Ian Taylor.
The fiery red and black shaggy coat of the so-called velvet ant does more than warn the unsuspecting that it packs a powerful sting. However, it is that shaggy coat that protects it from the heat of its desert home. The insect that is popularly called the velvet ant is actually a wingless wasp and is often found in hot, sandy desert areas. This little wasp's coat of fur helps to insulate it from the heat of the desert sand that can reach temperatures as high as 130 degrees. Many creatures, even plants that live in this hot environment, have protective fur coats, often tinged with white, to help reflect the heat. Digger wasps that live in the same environment even have little silvery hairs between their eyes in order to protect their tiny brains from the heat. It is from this environment that one popular landscaping plant, the dusty miller, comes with its silvery protective covering over its normally green leaves. The clothes and the coats we wear for protection merely emulate those in the rest of living creation, but are weak images of our ultimate need for protection. When our first parents, Adam and Eve, sinned, God provided them with fur coverings of animal skins. Yet these were only pointers towards the perfect covering for our sins provided by Jesus Christ.
For a printed transcript of today's program, visit our website at creationmoments.com or call us toll-free at 1-800-42-BIBLE. And be sure to join us next time for another Creation Moments, proclaiming evidence of God's truth.
Perhaps it's as gratifying for you as it is for us at AM 850 KFUO to hear how the station you support touches the lives of listeners. Bill writes, "I'm in the process of moving from St. Louis to a small town called Wellman, Iowa. I'm thankful that I can still listen to KFUO via the internet, even though I can't listen to it in the car anymore. And by the way, I still plan on being there for Share-a-thon next year. Bill, thanks for writing, thanks for listening, and we'll keep you in our prayers."
The Light the Night Walk. Make plans to participate in this 2-mile walk on Friday evening, September 12th in Forest Park. Funds raised through Light the Night support the work of hundreds of the world's best and brightest researchers in their search for better therapies and cures for leukemia, lymphoma, and myeloma. Anyone can take part. Children, adults, and seniors are all welcome. For more information, call Sharon at 618-259-0065 or visit lightthenight.org.
Back at our Bible study program, I'm Chuck Rathert. Vice President Bill Diekelman, Vice President, First Vice President of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is our guest here today. And our numbers are 505-7850 and 1-800-730-2727. Let's take a call here and talk to Al. Hi, Al. You're on the Bible study.
Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning.
I'm sorry, your guest, is he a pastor? Should I address him as pastor?
Well, he is an ordained man. He is not currently serving a congregation. He's currently serving as the vice president, first vice president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
Okay, all righty. Well, sir, I just want, and I'd like to stay on for this small conversation. One comment that you just had talked about with the teaching of the children, teaching them in a way to protect them. Could you tell me what that means?
Well, we were talking about this in the context of information that our children receive in ways that are not necessarily taught to them through media exposure, through conversations with people, with other kids at school, and I think the importance here is to get right information to our children. And they're going to find out about sexual matters. They're going to find out about it from their classmates at school. They're going to find out it from movies. And I think it's very important that we provide right information for the protection of our children, that we don't back away from having serious conversations with our kids, and so that we know that they know now what is the truth.
Okay, that's a good point. And I understand that now. And in an age of where we're at right now, with as far as we have our priorities totally mixed up, I hear you saying that the stepping down, so to speak, of authority by a pastor's and being more on a buddy system with people is the, I hear that that is the way that we're moving into as a Lutheran denomination. Would you consider that true?
Well, I would hope that pastors and congregations always have a friendly relationship with one another, and that they are able to do the work of the church in that way, that pastors are not remote and removed from the congregation, or that people in the congregation would, you know, keep their pastor at a distance and, you know, not involve him in every aspect of their lives. I don't know that they need to be taking vacations together necessarily, but I think to do the work of the church, you know, and I'm not saying that and pastors need to be on a have their parishioners on a first name basis with them or not refer to them as pastor. I think that that title of respect is important in the setting of the church.
And let me respond to that too, Al, since I was the one who brought it up.
Yeah.
I think, because I hope I didn't communicate this, but I don't think I was advocating that we substitute a buddy system and set aside the authority of the pastor or the authority of that office.
What I
think I was trying to probe was we are now in a much more relationship-driven kind of a culture than we used to be. It used to be that... the pastor was like the cop on the beat or something. You didn't have to know anything about him personally, and you didn't care. But it's not like that anymore.
I know. And one last comment on that.
Okay.
And not that you implied that at all, Chuck. No, I didn't pick that up from you. But
I say some stupid things from time to time, Al. You never
well,
know.
I know that, but that wasn't one of them. But what I see already, well, it started forming in our Lutheran churches, golly, maybe 12 years ago already, was in this process of wanting to be everybody's friend and wanting to, not everybody's friend, but everybody's buddy. What you see is leadership within the church then dressing themselves down, literally removing that respectful position that they have and becoming way too casual with not only appearance but in their teachings, going away from theological teachings and Bible studies are where people actually can be fed, and instead feeding their everyday needs, of which that's a war that will never win.
All right. Thank you, Al. Let's see what Pastor Diekelman has to say.
Well, I think that's exactly right, Al. I think that, clergy are professional people. I think they must conduct themselves as professional people. Again, that doesn't mean they need to be separate from their interaction with a congregation, but they do. They are leaders in that place, and they are the ones that the congregation looks to for spiritual leadership, for theological leadership. Our pastors are trained professionals in this area, and I think it's important that they conduct themselves as such.
All right, I want to stay on the children theme here because, and I think you touched on this before, this was a dramatic way of putting it, that as you grew up, you were protected by your parents from the stigma of divorce. Now, they didn't even want to use the D word around you because it is such an unfortunate thing, and it carries with it a certain amount of baggage, particularly among church people. But since that time, since those protections have been removed, there is not just a removal of protection, but there is an assault on our kids to sexualize them. The way they dress and what they see in their video games and certainly what we see on television and what we see in the movies, it seems to me that that, more than anything else, represents the largest shift in our culture, the sexualization of our kids. So now, of course, we know that we have kids who are having kids. That's one of the themes of the current presidential election, because we have a vice presidential candidate who has a 17-year-old pregnant daughter. So I'm looking at the USA Today. I'm looking through some of the opinion pieces there. And there is a woman by the name of, I guess it's Ilana Zion, who lives in Philadelphia. And she makes this suggestion. She says, while I agree that abstinence education works, and that would be teaching a protection, it seems to me, it works best when coupled with sex education. As stated in USA Today's editorial, studies have shown that abstinence-only education does not work. Also, the teen birth rate has increased since the Bush administration provided funding for abstinence-only education. I have a young daughter. When she is old enough to understand, I plan to teach her that abstinence is best, but that if she wants to have sex, here is how to have sex safely. Teaching our children a combination of abstinence and safe sex has been shown to work best. Don't our children deserve the best, Vice President Diekelman? To me, this was a mixed message and was confusing, but then, as Al pointed out, sometimes I'm not the brightest guy in the crowd. So can you help me out here?
Yes, I can. As a parent of three daughters and now three granddaughters, as a pastor, as the son of loving parents himself, I was, first as a parent and a pastor, I felt it important that our children knew about sexuality, that they had education about sexuality, about their bodies, about emotions, about how those kinds of things influence their life as they become older, especially in teenaged years. I have never advocated anything other than abstinence until marriage. Don't, and I won't. I do not think that that is what God has taught us. I think as Lutheran Christians in particular, but as Christians, we are bound by God's commandment to us in the sixth commandment, as Luther explained it, to lead a chaste and decent life. I don't know what's in the New Catechism. That's what was in the one that I learned some years ago. So there is no room in there for safe sex. Safe sex is no sex until marriage. Now, we all realize sin is sin and people are people, but I think that as far as the church or as parents, that we have an obligation to our children. I think this is something, by the way, that you can expect in a Lutheran school, that you will learn that the right way for you to use the sexuality that God has given to you is in the boundaries of marriage.
I'm puzzled by the quote-unquote wisdom, ending here with a question, don't our children deserve the best? And the assertion that the best is advocating the position that you just shared, I don't and I won't, or however you put that, but at the same time, realizing that sin is sin, and so you need to teach your daughters, your children, if they're going to have sex, here's how to have it and have it safely. That's what Ilana is saying here in her editorial letter to USA Today. And it seems to me, I'm stuck on the horns of a dilemma. It seems to me that if you take a pure path of abstinence and abstinence only, you're setting yourself up for the failure that so many parents have experienced when one of their children comes up, father or mother. But if you do teach a safe sex route, you've undone your abstinence message, and you might well not have done it in the first place.
Correct. And that's why I said sin is sin. There is going to be a father or mother that wasn't planning to be a father or mother because of sin. For that, we know there is forgiveness. But we also know that the grace of God is not here for license to sin. And I would feel as a parent to tell my children I know that your emotions are going to lead you to the back seat of the car, whatever it is. So here, let me prepare you for that moment when you can't resist any longer. Would be a wrong thing for me as a parent to be teaching my children. It would be a wrong thing for me as pastor to be even allowed to be taught in school on my campus or any place else in my parish.
So how would you respond to this argument? I suspect that you are a decidedly pro-life man. I know that the church body for which you work has a clear pro-life position. Teaching safe sex helps avoid that horrible outcome of abortion. And being a pro-lifer, then, logically it would follow that you would be in favor of teaching same-sex methods. How would you respond?
I respond that the message of and the teaching of abstinence is just as powerful as any message for safe sex. I'm just trying to think of the national program for teenagers. I can't quite think of it now. We did it at our parish, and in Washington D.C. every year, you know, teenagers would gather, and my own children were part of this, where they promised, and we did this in our church during a church service. That the teenage children promised that they, and this was after a period of education about sexuality, and not methods, contraceptive methods, but about sexuality. And at the end of that time, then we had a very special service, and my kids were part of it. I promise that I am not going to engage in sexual relationships until marriage. And I think that's as powerful as teaching contraceptive methods.
If you had a young son or a young daughter who said to you something like, "Ah, Dad, you're just a dinosaur. You're just stuck in the Stone Age here. Things have changed. Things are different. Look, even Sarah Palin's daughter, you know, she's pregnant. She's just 17 years old, and, you know, it's not the end of the world, and they're going to get married, and life's, you know, they're going to be okay." How would you respond to that argument?
Well, I'm sure that parents hear that every day, Chuck, and I'm sure that every day there is some parent that is either heartbroken that their daughter or son announces that they're going to be, you know, grandparents. The tragedy of it is that there probably are parents that just shrug and go on, and don't bother to take time to talk with their child about what their child might be going through. And I probably am a dinosaur, but I think that what I am espousing right here is the Word of God, and is what God would have us to know, and it's the way that He would have us behave.
You said something interesting that might come as a surprise to some people who listen to you talk and say, "That guy, you know, he's allowed no wiggle room. It's abstinence and abstinence only, and he doesn't even want to teach safe sex methods. Boy, he is rigid and inflexible." But you used the word forgiveness there as you were talking. The son or daughter who has a father like you, or for that matter, like me, because I agree with you, it might be their worst nightmare to have to come to you and announce you're going to be a grandfather, that there's going to be a child out of wedlock because of all the positions that you've just espoused. So talk to me about forgiveness here a little bit.
That is, the greatest thing that our God has given to us. First, forgiveness for our own sins, and then the capacity through our own words, lifestyle, actions, to forgive those who in any way are entangled. And the Bible says, you know, do this gently. And I could only imagine the emotions that a parent would go through confronted with a situation that we're talking about, where one of their children was becoming a parent unplanned, and to try to find the right words and the right embrace to do that. But it's an important part of being a parent as well, because this isn't the only time that we are called on to demonstrate forgiveness to our children, or to have our children demonstrate forgiveness to us. It's part of being family. It's part of being the family of God. And this is how we live together as Christian people.
The other worst nightmare is the pastor. If you think you can somehow survive, moment of truth with mom and dad, I suppose the next step is the pastor, who I fully expect to let me have it because I've violated one of the Ten Commandments and I've disregarded what I learned in my confirmation class, etc., etc. That's my next visit that I don't ever want to have to make. Should the person with an unplanned pregnancy go see his pastor or her pastor?
Absolutely. I was just while you were prefacing that, recalling the first time as a pastor that I spoke with a teenager who was pregnant. And the situation was this: mom and dad hauled their daughter into my office and said, "Here, you let her have it." And I, after listening to
her, this is your first
experience was with those three people sitting across from my desk, and the mom and dad were still so angry that they hadn't addressed it. So their first response was, "We got to go see the pastor." And after listening to this young girl's words of confession and repentance, I announced the words of absolution to her, which I think shocked Dad, not Mom, but Dad, as I still recall the look on his face. And then
why Dad and not Mom, you think?
I'm not quite sure. Probably felt some embarrassment, I think, or how is he going to explain this in the community, because it was a small town and everybody was going to know, if they didn't already know, what was going on. And probably just his ego was getting slapped at a little bit right there. But in that moment, the Spirit of God took over and he realized, this is my daughter, and he embraced her, and it was a good thing.
Do they all work out that well?
I wish. I've sat across that desk a number of times, Chuck, with sometimes with parents, sometimes without parents. Generally with young people, how am I going to tell my parents? And sometimes I...
And what do you tell them?
Well, you just have to, number one, don't lie. Just tell them the truth. Tell them what happened. It's best if you can just go and do that. If you want me to be there, I'd be happy to be there with you. But, this is something you've got to do. And ask their forgiveness. And parents, for the most part, are very understanding and forgiving. They're angry at first, they grieve about this, and have, some of them have immediate, you have to do this, this, or this right away, within the first 10 seconds that this has been disclosed. So, it's either this or this. And you know how it gets sometimes when you're facing a crisis.
Have you ever had to counsel parents away from pressuring their daughter to have an abortion?
Yes. In fact, it provided some good opportunities for preaching when it was known in the congregation that there's either a father or mother in that congregation now that wasn't planning to be a father or mother, and to say, we've talked about this, and this child is going to be born, and abortion is not an option. And it was a way that I saw the Lord's hand of blessing in a difficult situation.
Kids have more problems than just unplanned pregnancies. on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 being fully embracing the pastor and 1 being, that's the last guy I want to talk to, what's your experience with kids coming to the pastor with, I'm talking about fairly serious problems now, you know, not hangnails or something, but do kids approach the pastor?
I can speak for myself. I was approached for a variety of situations, but generally when things were out of control or when somebody was about to be found out, when someone was either caught with drugs or was so involved that they knew that they were in trouble and didn't want to go to mom and dad, didn't know, you know, to whom else they could go, didn't want to go to the guidance counselor at the school because, you know, that was going to be trouble. And generally prefaced with, you know, can I talk to you privately? I don't want my mom and dad to know about this. And I said, of course. And generally at the end of our time together, next step, tell mom and dad, always. And it generally always worked that way. In fact, I can't think of situations now where it didn't work out that way. And I said, you know, they need to know. They're your parents. They love you. And they're going to forgive you for this.
Do you think these guys sitting in the classrooms down here in Concordia Seminary know that that is in their future? I'm sure they're thinking about preaching and worship and weddings and things like that. Do they know that that kind of thing is in their future?
I did not.
You did not?
I did not. And when and it occurred a whole lot quicker than I would have ever thought when I think back on it right now. I mean, that was some of the first stuff.
Would you trade any of it if
not,
you could?
Not for a minute.
Not for a minute.
Not for
a minute.
And why
do you say that with such conviction?
Well, number one, it helped me grow spiritually. It taught me to be a pastor. I have to confess this. When I graduated from school, I thought I was a pastor. I'm starting to find out now some of the important things about being a pastor. Learned most recently at the feet of some children sitting on the steps of the church in July.
And that brings us full circle. Thanks for the conversation. Good to see you again.
Always a pleasure,
I'd like
Chuck.
To have you back at some point. That's Bill Diekelman. He is first vice president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, headquartered here in St. Louis. And getting ready to head out. Where are you going next?
See, I'm going to be in New Jersey this weekend. You know, we have a Fan Into Flame campaign going on here to raise $100 million in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and I'm going to go and talk to some folks about that.
You'll be on the East Coast.
Huh? I will.
God's blessings to you.
Thank you, sir.
And that's our Ask the Pastor Bible study. Thanks for listening.
Listen to Chuck Ratherton guests Monday through Friday at the same time on The Bible Study. The Bible Study is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for The Bible Study to continue. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can contact us on the internet at kfuo.org. For a free copy of The Bible Study, please visit the audio archive section of our homepage. That's kfuo.org. The Bible Study is a broadcast service of Worldwide KFUO.